Hello, everyone, and welcome to DTNS Labs Games. This is the second episode. My name is Patrick Beja, and I welcome again my fun and knowledgeable partner, Scott Johnson. Does that description suit you?
Sure. Yeah, I guess so. The knowledgeable part is arguable, but the the fun part, hey, I'm always down to clown. Let's do it.
Excellent. So for those who are joining us for the first time, this is an experimental DTNS centered not on tech, but on games. On the first episode, we covered the consoles of 2017 and the PC and Mac and VR headset and all of the gaming hardware that we could discuss to give you an overview of what that was for this year. On this episode, we're going to be covering the games of 2017. And I was thinking about how the best way to approach this would be. And I was wondering if we should give our opinions on the game, appreciation, you know, how good they are. I'm not sure. I mean, we'll mention how good we think they are. But a more interesting way to approach this for the DTNS audience, I think, is to let you know what the games are, where they come from, what audience they are targeting, and what the gameplay elements are, so that you can get an idea of, you know, maybe it's a good present to make, or maybe it's a good game to try out yourself, things like that.
Right.
And
yeah.
We're going to be covering the yearly classics. We're going to have the big IPs that you can see from other media, the Star Wars, the Lord of the Ring things, the multi-support games that are pretty big in the industry. We're going to have the PlayStation exclusives and the Switch exclusives. And yeah, so hopefully after this episode, you'll have a more precise view of what the gaming landscape is like at the end of this year. And this year has been very active. So I'm saying at the end of this year, but we're really going to be covering everything from the beginning of the year. Anything you want to add, Scott, before we launch into it?
Just that there may be a sense for some that that we're giving Xbox a little bit of short shrift here in terms of exclusives. And the fact of the matter is they're very short on those this year, despite the fact that they've got a hot new console out. We talked about that last time. And despite that, there's nothing really there that you would go, oh, look at this awesome launch exclusive for the Xbox One X. I think we'll hit on some that are definitely exclusive to them, but they're not necessarily like, oh, wow, look at this breakout hit that only I can get on the Sony platform or I can only get on the Switch. There really aren't any of those, sadly, for the Xbox this year. So I think just keep that in mind as we get to it. Doesn't mean that you can't get fine gaming experiences on the Xbox, but you may find a sort of lack of first-party focus from them this year.
Right. Most of the games we're going to be talking about until we get to the PlayStation 4 and Switch exclusives are also going to be available for the most part on Xbox, and in some cases on PC as well. So it's not that there aren't many games on the Xbox. It's that the exclusives, as we discussed many times, sadly aren't quite there. They did mention that they're going to remedy that, but how long that will take is kind of a question mark. So anyway, let's start with what I call the classics, like the yearly classics that traditionally we're used to seeing almost every year. And I think the biggest video game still now in most people's minds is Call of Duty. And that game has been huge for a decade, and it's not as huge nowadays, but it is still very important in the gaming world. And this episode is Call of Duty World War II. So let me describe very quickly what Call of Duty is. It's a first-person shooter, military-based, and it tries to be somewhat realistic. It's still easy to get into. It's not hard, very difficult to master in the sense that they would try to make it as real as possible. It's not a simulation. It's still very much arcadey, but it's still, you know, the kind of game that you play when you want to. This is kind of hard to present like that, but have fun playing soldiers, I guess.
Sure, why not?
And
I think that's a fair way of putting
it. Yeah, have fun playing. It's playing Soldier in a virtual environment. It has a military, a single-player campaign, and a big part is the multiplayer campaign when you play against other players and teams. It's usually regarded, and it quite frankly is, the Michael Bay-type movie of games. It's got a lot of action set pieces that are really impressive, that hit you in the wow part of your brain. It's not a very critically acclaimed series, but usually it does its job. And it seems that this year, with the return to an era of World War II, when they had been more modern in the past few years, they've managed to capture the interest of some of the gamers.
Yeah, they haven't done so. So just for a quick history lesson, the original Call of Duty games were all set in World War II, Call of Duty 1 and 2. And they broke ranks with all of that with Call of Duty 4, or what they called Modern Warfare. And that game changed everything. It included a progression system that literally changed first-person shooter progression forever. And that's across the board. Like, no matter where you're at, if you're getting XP in a shooter, it is easy to forget that that all started with Call of Duty. And a pretty massive change to the way you would progress in those games. Previous to that, you just kind of won games. You didn't progress anywhere. You would win or lose, and that was pretty much it. But the important thing to note here is they have stayed kind of in the modern era, then into the near future era, and then into a far-flung future era in recent years, which I really enjoyed. I thought that was a great direction for it. I know a lot of people disagree with me, but from a single-player standpoint, that was more interesting to me. This World War II back thing is for old fans and new fans to kind of check out what they used to kind of do with some of the more modern sensibilities that came after Modern Warfare. And the reviews are, you know, about where you expect them, 60 to 80% sort of, you know, generally people are like, yeah, it's Call of Duty again. It feels about the same. Welcome back to World War II.
And I think that's something that is important to note for people who are used to games that might expect a little bit more innovation of their games. But for people who just buy one game every year, or maybe every other year, or who haven't played Call of Duty games for a while, I'm guessing that this one might be a nice, fun, easy to get into experience. And a lot of people buy basically a sports game and Call of Duty every year, and they're very happy. So, another one of those big yearly franchises is Assassin's Creed. And last year, they took a year off because the game was getting a little bit stale, and critics were letting the company know about that. And they have taken a year off and come back with Assassin's Creed Origins, which maybe you can tell us about a little bit.
Yeah, briefly, it is awesome. I've always been an Assassin's Creed fan, but in particular, 2, Brotherhood, Black Flag, and the one that came out in 2015, which is the last one before this.
But what is it, Scott?
Here's what you do. You're a dude, right, or a lady sometimes, who is an assassin. And you got to assassinate people. So what you do is you sneak around and you shank them in the neck with a knife, or you hang them up with a rope, or you push them off a cliff, or you...
That sounds horribly violent.
Fire a knife into their neck from afar, sneak up on them. Sometimes just subdue them, not actually kill them, hide them in the bushes, move on to the next guy. There's a lot of stealth gameplay there. You can also kind of go in guns blazing, or in the case of this game, swords blazing. What makes this different this year, this sort of stealth action thing, is not only a return to a very strict adherence to the history of the place you're in. I mean, this is straight up ancient Egypt in every way. When you get to parts of Roman-controlled Alexandria and other places, it is very accurately portrayed, both geographically.
Right, because just to interrupt you for just a second, what you didn't mention is the fact that is very much a very important element of those games is the historical settings. It visits a different era every game. And this time, you know, we've been to the Italy in the Renaissance. We've been to the Middle East in the first one was early millennium, I guess, early in the millennium, the first one. We've been in the French Revolution period, etc. And this one is set in Egypt towards Ptolemy era.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be the beginning of the Assassin's Creed, or the Assassin's Guild, or whatever you want to call them, in their quest to take down the Illuminati, which consists in all of these eras, and there's always a group of assassins. Usually play one, and you do lots of missions, and you try to help the people. You're a freedom fighting Robin Hood of types, except you're very murderous. That's the one big difference in you and Robin Hood. But anyway, this thing really sets itself apart for maybe if you're listening and you're going, well, Scott, I never really liked the Assassin's Creed formula. I'm more of an RPG guy. Boy, do I have good news for you, because this game plays and feels a lot like, I would compare it favorably to something like The Witcher, or even a little bit of Red Dead Redemption thrown in there. It's definitely a familiar experience, but with some new elements like gear and swappable gear and drops and sort of a RPG sort of quest system mixed in with the Assassin's Creed formula. And it's a strong, strong outing. I think it's maybe one of the best, if not the best ones they've done. And I'm really digging it. Now, I'm biased because I love ancient Egypt and I'll play anything on a desert. So I'm kind of biased, but I really, really like it and think it's in my top three or four of the year. I love it.
And I think it's an easy game. I mean, systems-wise, it's a little bit more complex than something like Call of Duty, but the setting make it really easy to appreciate, even for someone who's not a very, who's not a big gamer. So it's one that you might be able to recommend as one of the big games of the year for people who only buy a handful of games.
I agree.
Next, we have kind of the broad category of sports games, which get an update every year. You have the FIFAs and the Maddens and the NBA 2K and all of those, which I don't think either of us are very much into. And so it's kind of hard to give you a recommendation on one specifically, but they're so specifically tailored to particular interest that people who want to play football are going to buy FIFA. People who want to play American football are going to buy Madden. And people who want to play, it's kind of like there's one big player in each of those sports, and that's the game that you're going to buy if you want to play those games. I think that's a fair assessment, right? So we have to mention it, but
I think so as well. The only one comment I would make is the one sports game I do get into a little bit more regularly than I used to. I used to play a lot more sports games back in the day, but for me, it's any of the hockey games. So the NHL 2018 game that came out this year, pretty great. I recommend it. It's good. I wish it was on PC. That's all I'll say about that. But good luck, FIFA and Madden people. I'm sure you have what you want.
Yeah, it's also one of those things that people who don't necessarily adore video games for the video games part get into every year and have a lot of fun with friends and family. And really on those ones, there isn't, I don't think, a way to go wrong. Just get the latest one. And yeah, some people might tell you, well, it's not as good as this or this one. If you don't already know which one you want, by that I mean if there are two football games, which is very rare these days, but if there are two, if you don't already know which one you want, both are going to be competent. And yeah, Most of the time, there's only one.
I agree.
There's also the racing games. This year we had Forza Motorsport 7 on the Xbox and Gran Turismo Sport on PlayStation 4. So both of those are exclusive to that platform, to their respective platform. Both are very, very good. A little bit different. Forza is a little bit more complete. It kind of covers everything about sports racing. Gran Turismo Sport is really about a simulation that tries to be as faithful as possible while remaining accessible. And they have this deal with the FIA, I think. The basically one of the racing federations. And it goes to the extent that if you manage to attain a certain level of proficiency in Gran Turismo Sport, you get an actual license for driving cars in the real world. And then you have all of these for driving race cars in the real world. And then you have all of these online competitions that try to remain as close as possible to actual racing, but on the console. So you will have things like encouragement to not bump into other cars, as you sometimes do in sports games, because it doesn't matter. You're not going to crash your actual car and things like that. Forza Motorsports on the Xbox is a little bit more classic racing game where you don't have all of that focus on realism, even though they are very precisely tailored. So it's kind of a misnomer to say they don't focus on realism. They kind of do, but not to the extent that Gran Turismo does in their approach. And what I'm hearing from most people is that Forza is a little bit more fun, actually, and Gran Turismo Sport is a bit for people who are very, very, very serious about their racing, right?
Yeah, Gran Turismo has always been about, I wouldn't say car porn, but it's like a, it's more like, you know, you're collecting these trophies, and by trophies I mean cars, and you're very interested in slow moving cameras showing the contours of the back of the car. You're less, you know, it's less about fun factor and more about, you know, just car love. And this always sort of been true of Gran Turismo. And then, you know, I think Forza has always aimed for a little bit more of an accessible experience, but still the mainline Forzas are still pretty, you know, pretty hardcore in terms of realism and simulation and all of that. So they both kind of accomplish the same goal. Forza has been a lot more regular, like yearly pretty much, whereas Gran Turismo is sort of like, when's the next one coming out? We don't know. We heard a rumor. It's five
in a few years. Yeah.
In a way that makes that game even more attractive to those people who love the rarity of it all. But neither of them are for me. I should state that. What I really wish this year what we had was a better arcade sort of experience. You could call Mario Kart's re-release on the Switch, perhaps that. For me, but there's no real middle ground, and the latest Need for Speed is getting panned pretty hard, which bums me out because that was kind of a great place to go for a more arcade experience with racing. So yeah, I'm bummed that there's, you know, the burnout paradises of the world seem to have stopped, and all we're left with is hardcore sims, and that's kind of a bummer.
Well, we should mention, you said that Forza Motorsport 7 is in the mainline series. They also have the Forza Horizon, the latest of which is Forza Horizon 3 that came out last year. And it's also exclusive to the Xbox. And those are a little bit more centered on, well, fun. You evolve in a very large area, and you kind of pick up missions as you drive around, and you should do this and jump over that and race to that point. It's less like a race and more of a, well, there's lots of elements of racing, of course, but it's more arcadey fun. So that's also available. And just to make it clear, the Gran Turismo Sport is a little bit different from the traditional Gran Turismos, which are more akin to Forza Motorsport 7, where you have a ton of circuits, hundreds of cars, and not as much that focus on the online aspect of it, the online competition. And they really want to make like almost real life like tournaments with Gran Turismo Sport, and they have less cars, less circuits, etc., etc.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's move on to the big IPs from other media, things like Star Wars and DC Comics and Shadow of Lord of the Rings. Star Wars Battlefront 2 is coming out in a couple of days at the moment we're recording this, and is getting into a little bit of a controversy, which we talked about yesterday as, again, we're recording this on DTNS, because there's a lot of issues with their business model, which includes loot boxes. And loot boxes have been in many games this year and have created a controversy of their own, but in this game specifically, it seemed like they were including elements that can affect the gameplay, and you have to pay for those loot boxes where you get items for the game, and you have to pay for the loot boxes after having paid for the game at a full price, which gamers did not appreciate, and in this case, I think it's justified. So we won't go into that controversy, but you have to keep it in mind as well. The game itself includes a single-player campaign, and it includes the core of the game is more of the multiplayer elements, where the fact that you can buy specific items that make you better, or you have to play a lot to get a character you would like Darth Vader or Luke Skywalker, is something that might be a little bit of an impediment to your enjoyment. But that being said, the game is gorgeous, very good looking. The single player campaign is fun for what it is. It will take you 6 or 7 hours to complete, and then you can go and dabble in the multiplayer, where you have it's a third-person shooter, is it? Or first-person?
No, it's first-person.
First-person, right. So when you get it, I think it's when you get into a hero, like, again, Darth Vader, that you get into third-person, I thought.
Oh, right. That is correct. Yeah. So if you become one of the heroes, you the camera pans out, and you're basically a super soldier-style, you know, overpowered kind of monster for a little bit.
Right.
To me, it's like an ultimate almost in a game like Overwatch or something, where you're just, for a minute there, you're just unstoppable. So
the game is really at its core a multiplayer experience where you will take part into different battles from the side of the Republic, well, Rebellion, depending on the era, or the Empire, or the new evil people.
Oh, the First Order.
There you go. And yeah. So they mix in a lot of different movie characters and soldiers, and so there's a big factor of getting to live in that world and fight in that world with those characters that you remember fondly. I'm having a hard time recommending it with that issue of loot boxes, but I think for someone who doesn't really care about games all that much but enjoys them a little bit sometimes and loves Star Wars, I'm wondering if that's not something they might enjoy.
I think that let's put it this way. If you're looking for a very cool, from what I've heard, very cool story, like a great campaign, if that's your main goal here, like it is for me with like Call of Duty, I really don't care about the multiplayer in those games anymore, despite the fact that that's kind of their primary focus. But I like a good campaign in a shooter, and I have plenty of other multiplayer shooters where I don't have campaigns, and I'm totally fine with that. So don't really need more of that. If you're that person, I'm going to recommend the game. I think you should get it and should play it and should really enjoy it. If your goal is to get this as a multiplayer experience, and you are put off by play-to-win mechanics, meaning if I grind this out, it'll take me 12 hours and I can earn Darth Vader. But if I want to get there quicker and pay for it, then I can beat everybody to the punch, and then you're kind of on the hook for the money for the loot boxes. If that bothers you, I say stay away from the game. I think EA is overextended this, even though they've dropped the price of the thing.
Like the in-game price, meaning it will take you less time in-game to get those items as opposed to shelling out the money to get them immediately.
Yeah, they slashed it by
75%, yeah.
Yeah, which is a lot. That's a lot of slack, yeah. But it's also just nuts. Like, everything about this controversy is crazy to me, and it really is unfortunate because a lot of really great developers, creators, behind the scenes, technical people, artists, designers, directors, all of these guys worked their A's off on this game.
And it's gorgeous.
And it's beautiful. Really, yeah. And by all accounts, the story's great. The voice acting's incredible. Like, all of that stuff's supposed to be super neat. It's just marred by this business decision that is likely nothing to do with any of those creative people I mentioned. So, well, it's one of the sticklers of the games business. Mm-hmm. It's a business, but it's also this creative endeavor and sometimes artistic endeavor. And sometimes those two things clash. So I don't think they're handling it well. I think it's all very weird. But I'll stand by this idea that if you are looking for a good single-player experience and you love Star Wars, I don't think anything should hold you back. And that price is what video games cost. You also have the argument on the developer side saying that, you know, $59 is... the games inflation doesn't move with the rest of the world's inflation. So,
well, they don't move at all. They're the price they cost 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's really weird. Yet the price of hiring people, maintaining developers and studios,
and the budgets for the games are much higher than they were 30 years ago.
Way higher. Yet here we are paying roughly the same price for the game. So I kind of get that side of it too, and I understand they're desperate to find new methods of doing this. I think Blizzard does it better than everyone else, but I'm also biased, so you know, whatever. But
it's a call
on that game. I think that people should buy it if they want a good single player. I think the multiplayer really puts me off, and I don't want to do that. So that's where I'm.
Yeah, as a gamer who likes this industry and who wants to take a stand sometimes when it's necessary, I feel like I have to for this game because of that controversy. But yeah, for everything else, I agree with you on the recommendation.
Yeah.
Middle Earth Shadow of War is a game set into the universe, the world of Lord of the Rings, but it has very little to do with the actual novel. You'll find an odd character here and there from the novels. You'll find settings and people and monsters and things like that, but it could very much be an entirely different property. It wouldn't impact the game all that much. Still, it's the sequel from a very successful game called Shadow of Mordor, and you play the role of a the people of not Gondor. They're I can't remember.
Hold on, Rohan.
Is it?
Yeah, writers. Isn't it Rohan? Isn't he a writer of Rohan?
He probably is. Let's go with that. I'm sure someone will correct us. But so basically he died, and his body is inhabited by the ghost of the the maker of the rings. And it gives him supernatural powers in that world, which has lots of supernatural elements. And your goal is to conquer the lands of Mordor. And right. So there are two elements to the game, mainly. There's the immediate moment-to-moment gameplay, where you have a third-person view of your character and you fight orcs and, usually orcs through stealth and combat and ranged and melee combat, and that part is very satisfying to me. It's a little bit systems heavy, but I think it's easy enough to get into. And then you have another element to the game, which is each region of that world you have to conquer has a very specific military structure of orcs that you can affect. And you can, for example, if you need to launch a siege against a castle, you have different captains that you can identify that protect it. And they themselves have bodyguards. So if you go and kill or convert those bodyguards, it will be much easier to overtake the captain, or maybe even to make him your ally through the will of that weird ghost that gives you powers. And so you have to sort of build your assault sneakily through exploring that world and deciding how you're going to approach it. They all have their strengths and weaknesses, and it takes a little while, and then you can launch your assault and conquer that fortress. So those two elements are very well mixed together. I loved the game. There's a loot box controversy element to it as well, but I found that the loot boxes were done right in that they really didn't affect the gameplay of people who were invested in the game at all. So that was my impression of that. Honestly, the loot boxes are completely non-mandatory, so I felt that was not a big issue. And the game is really good.
You should also say this: the game, the loot box controversy, it was on their doorstep as the big one of the year for about 2 weeks there, and Star Wars swooped in and kind of took all the heat. So I think everyone's kind of forgotten now that that Mordor was having those issues. So it's all good now.
Yeah, and even more than that, honestly, the loot boxes are unnecessary. It's a very long, it's a long campaign, maybe 20 hours, 15, 20 hours.
Yeah.
And then you have a kind of a post-game campaign if you want to keep playing, and that is really, really long. And some people will tell you, oh, at that point you need the loot boxes, or it's so long that it's not fun. And the second part is kind of true. It's a little bit unfortunate. They were looking for a way to extend the lifetime of the game beyond the actual campaign. Mm-hmm. And they sort of made it into something that is less fun than the actual campaign is. And it's very, very long. But it's supposed to be, because it's the thing you do when you're done with the game, but you still want to keep playing it. They wanted to give you an incentive to keep playing it. And that part is not great, but you still have, 15, 20 hours of a fully realized game to play through. So I like that one quite a bit.
Cool. I'm glad I didn't play it, because I knew Origins and Mario were coming, and I couldn't see how I could fit it in. It's kind of like Destiny 2 for me. Like I know that's going to be around, so I'm not in any kind of rush. I'll get Mordor on sale at some point, or War rather. Yeah, Shadow of War, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
The Mordor name out. But yeah, like there's so much. This is one of the problems with 2017. You've called it. What did you – you had a name for this.
Axiom 17. It's the fact that when – thank you. It's the fact that we have so many good games that we have to opt out of some of the good games we would want to play because there are other better ones that we want to play more. So the fact that we're not playing some of those games doesn't mean they're not good. It's just that we have other better ones we want to play.
Yeah, I agree. And it's been crazy. So for me, it was just like, yeah, I need to pace myself.
Yeah.
Myself in a better place for this. And I will eventually get around to it. But I think there's a lot of mainstream appeal to that game. I think people would like it.
Injustice 2 is a fighting game based on the DC Comics IP. So you have Superman, Batman, The Flash, etc., etc. All of those characters, Wonder Woman, all of those, who square off in a bombastic campaign of a fighting game, and you can also fight against your friends. So fighting games is a genre where, you know, the one like Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat, actually it's the developers of Mortal Kombat that make this game. So you have, it's one versus one, you see them from the side, and you have special moves, and you fight until one of you two is down on the ground and can't get up. So that's the fighting game genre. And yep. I think Injustice is a franchise that is quite highly regarded as understanding that these games have to be accessible and fun to reach a wide audience. And for a license like DC Comics, they kind of have to, because it's not necessarily super technical fighting game fans that are going to be interested in this, but maybe people who like the comics that are going to gravitate towards it. So I haven't played the second one specifically, but it's getting pretty good reviews, and it might be something fun to play with your friends if you are a fan of DC Comics, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's you don't even have to be a fan of other NetherRealms games like Mortal Kombat. I think you can just dive right into that thing and feel good about it. Feel good about your life. It's a fun, fast-paced game with a cool progression mechanic and some neat DLC if you're into that. You know, it's the fighting game of the year. I love that those guys have been able to figure out a way to extend their reach well beyond MK and into other properties like this. It's great.
Yeah. South Park is a TV show that some people might enjoy, and if they do, they might enjoy the role-playing game South Park. So I'm going to wait a second before I tell the name of that episode. The first one was The Stick of Truth, and it's an RPG series, so role-playing game. And this one is called, in purest South Park fashion, The Fractured But Whole. Right? Did I say it right?
The Fractured, comma, Butthole.
Exactly.
doesn't matter how you say it. It sounds like butthole.
So yeah, yeah. So very South Park. It is based in the world of South Park, and it looks exactly like the cartoon. It's striking how well they've managed to make it faithful to the cartoon. So you play the role of one of the kids. You design him, the kid, him or her, as you want in that South Park aesthetic. There's a fun slash interesting social commentary on it, where the difficulty of the game is set by the tone of your skin. So the darker your skin, the more difficult the game is going to be, which is a very South Park thing to do in social commentary area. Mm-hmm. And you'll be part of the adventure that the kids are living. The first one was kind of Dungeons and Dragons type environment, and this one is more superheroes. And the fractured element is a reference to what's happening in the Marvel universe with the Civil War movie, where two groups of superheroes are fighting for something. And in this case, it's two groups of the South Park kids who are fighting for probably something trivial. But it's a pretty good role-playing game. You know, it's turn-based combat. It has on this... this version of the game has positioning, which is important as well. So if you like those kinds of games, you might be interested in this one.
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, I've heard it's good. I played the first one, loved it. Again, this will be one I sneak in when I have some time.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to other games that are not based on popular other media IPs. We have, of course, you mentioned it, Destiny 2, sequel to Destiny 1, one might infer. It's a basically a big space opera type universe where you play a hero that is protecting the Earth and the colonized solar system that humans have, well, colonized, and that is being threatened by different alien races and invaders. And it is one of the only games of its type at the time. Now there are a few others, but it's heavily multiplayer, single-player experience. Does that make any sense?
I think so. I mean, it's I don't know, that game's weird. The whole the series is weird, but the second one is even weirder in the sense that I'm talking to way more friends who are playing it by themselves than people who are playing it with groups. Not that there aren't people playing it with groups or won't graduate to that, but they seem to have made a much more accessible, I want to go this on my own kind of experience, you know, like World of Warcraft does and other games that they may ultimately want you playing with other people, but they have given you a path that doesn't mean you have to.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's basically you can play it alone or you can play it with friends. It is much more fun with friends, but it's also very fun alone. I played it solo from beginning to end, and there isn't really an end. You can keep playing it for a long time, but it's still, you know, mostly you can play it as a solo experience. And it's great fun. I really like it. There are issues when you reach the quote-unquote end because, unlike other games of a similar type, you can't play it for hundreds of hours, but you can easily play it for 100 hours. So that's something. And it's a first-person shooter. Excellent first-person shooter feel. It's the developer behind the Halo series on the Xbox platform. So they know their stuff. So
yeah, and you can get it anywhere. PC version's really nice. And the thing that I would say about it is it's a very evergreen property, meaning you can hop into Destiny now, or you can say, well, I don't have time right now, but in 6 months, that game will still be going strong. There will still be new content. It's very much a game as a service, sort of. It's not quite the same as that, but it's not going anywhere. Like, it's going to be there for you. The world won't dump it. Destiny is going to be here in some form for a very long time.
With the caveat that there are expansions, quote-unquote, that are going to be coming out. First one in December, second one in early next year. And that might complicate things a little bit, but maybe not for someone who's just looking to play through the campaign and a little bit more afterwards.
Yep.
Mass Effect Andromeda is another space-faring series of role-playing games in that case. And it's a weaker installment of the series, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. It's a highly regarded series, but this this opus is not very critically acclaimed. It might be critically panned, so I wouldn't recommend it if you want to play the Mass Effect games.
Two is amazing. If you can get your hands on two through backwards compatibility or something, or a PC version, it's amazing. It's incredible. If you want to play three, three is okay, but two is the pinnacle for me, and it was one of the best games I ever played. But Andromeda, yeah, probably not worth the money.
Yeah, and it's a role-playing third-person or first-person shooter type hybrid. So yeah, go back to the earlier ones if you want to experience that world. Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus, is the sequel to Wolfenstein 1, which itself was kind of a reimagining of the very, very old Wolfenstein, Castle Wolfenstein, from the 90s, where originally you were just a dude shooting Nazis in the head and killing Mecha Hitler at the end of the game. So very silly, very old school, and they have reimagined that game into something that has surprised and delighted many, many of the critics and of the players. The first game came out a couple of years ago. This one just came out, and it's been probably one of the most highly regarded games of the year. And if it's not on people's Game of the Year shortlist, it's because there are so many other great games.
Yeah, there are, by the way, seven modern incarnations since Wolfenstein 3D in 92. Seven Wolfenstein games. Before that, there were two. It was inspired by Castle Wolfenstein in 81 and 84 is beyond Castle Wolfenstein. So technically nine total titles, including this new one, The New Colossus. Game has got legs, man, some roots. and is especially this year poignant in its marketing and its content. Because it's a sort of a, it's got a Nazi theme, of course, and it's
interesting resonates with today's concerns. Let's say
it does, and it's supposed to be fantastic. Again, another game I need to get to.
Yeah, and this is a first-person shooter with a heavy narrative element.
Very mature as well, so I would not. You know, this isn't for your 10-year-old. I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another game that is not for your 10-year-old is one of the phenomenons of this year. PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. Well, we won't go over the history of that game and how it came about, but suffice it to say, imagine 100 people on an airplane dropping down, parachuting down on an island, and there are structures, buildings, weapons, cars on the island, and they all drop down, and there has to be just one who survives, and it's a first-person shooter. And
it's Battle Royale. If you ever seen Battle Royale or the Hunger Games, kind of that idea.
And this is the first of the Game Awards Game of the Year finalists. Game Awards is probably the one organization nowadays that has the that sort of sets the tone for the Game of the Year. Everyone does their own, but this is the closest thing we have to a Academy, to an Academy Award type thing. One of the contenders. Phenomenal success. It's only $30 on PC. It's coming to Xbox One, not PlayStation 4, in a couple of weeks. It's not a game that I personally enjoy, but it seems the entirety of the world really likes it. And it's astoundingly successful.
Yeah, it's... Yes, it's ridiculously successful. There are now going to be a billion clones of it. There already are a few, some quite successful. The Fortnite free Battle Royale mode, which is an Unreal Tournament-based epic thing, is quite good and totally rips it off. And there are many more coming, and I would be surprised if in a couple of years every shooter game, mainstream shooter game, didn't have at least a mode that tried to replicate this. It is a literal phenomenon, and it's taken the world by storm.
Yeah. PlayStation 4 exclusives. Horizon Zero Dawn came out about, at the beginning of the year, and it's also been very, very much critically acclaimed. Another Game of the Year finalist, another contender from the Game Awards. Imagine a world that has been post-apocalyptic. So the way they call it is post-apocalyptic. So society has been destroyed and you have the remnants of society and you run around as the heroine Aloy in this world that has been taken over by machines, robots that look like dinosaurs. It seems convoluted, but they make it really works. Really work. It's a very open world game, so you run around. You can, you have different missions you can do. A main narrative thread you can follow. Fairly long game, relatively approachable, but definitely a gamey game, but excellent one.
Yeah, gamey in the best possible way. It's a really good game. Fantastic. I can't say enough about that. It's that one's in my top five of the year for sure. I hear the new DLC for it is really good. It is, I don't know, it's a crazy mix of lots of genres, but I think if you like the aforementioned Assassin's Creed and maybe, you know, Far Cry and some of those kinds of games, if you've played those in the past, Horizon Zero Dawn has a lot to offer you. It's really good. Mm-hmm.
Uncharted The Lost Legacy. So the Uncharted series is a heavily narrative game. They have gameplay elements that are really fun, but it's the main draw of it is the voice acting and the acting period. They do a lot of groundbreaking motion capture. They actually act out the scenes. And this one is an offshoot from the main series featuring two female protagonists for... an experience that is a little bit shorter than a main mainline game, maybe 10 hours, something like that, a little bit less. And still the same great formula. It's kind of the another one of those easy-to-get-into, fun video games that are, you know, huge sellers because they are crowd-pleasers.
Yeah, it's that one's a big one. You could do a lot worse. Then another Uncharted story. Also, it's about all you're going to get until Last of Us 2 comes out. So get in there, enjoy it, and find out for yourselves why Uncharted's great. It's even a great place to start with that series, weirdly, because it's standalone and doesn't really need the previous stuff.
It's also cheaper.
Yeah, it's also cheaper. That's another nice thing. So it's a nice little adventure, and it will immediately sell you, I think, on the Uncharted template. That's an incredible series. Really good.
Yeah. I did want to mention, without going too much into it, Nier Automata and Persona 5, which are Japanese games that are, again, incredibly highly regarded. If someone tells you you need to play those games, and you don't already know that you need to play those games, I think they don't have your best interest at heart. Because they are Japanese games that are incredibly gamer-centric. So it's the kind of thing you really enjoy if you know how games work and what's fun about certain systems, and they're quite complex. It's almost like auteur cinema, you know, a black and white thing produced last year where people speak, you know, only in grunts. And it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. And I'm exaggerating a little bit. I mean, the games are obviously great, but I don't think for someone who doesn't really know about games, they would be something I would recommend.
Yeah. I've played neither of those. I have Persona 5. I will probably at some point crack that open and get to it, but neither are games that jump out at me because they're anime as hell. So there's Scott's hot take.
Well, I wouldn't hold that against them if I wasn't Scott. but there are other things that you can hold against them if you're not a core gamer, I would say.
I agree, but I'm glad they exist. I will say that. I'm glad they're things people can play.
Yeah. For sure. And finally, the Switch exclusives. There are three of them. Mario Kart, which exists on the Wii U and on the Switch. Almost no one owns a Wii U, so it's probably a safe bet to say that you might be interested about it on the Switch. The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, also on the Wii U and the Switch. And Super Mario Odyssey. I don't think that we can cover all three of them together, but I almost want to, because they all have this magical Nintendo touch that makes them, that sets them apart, makes them great for anyone, kids, adults, gamers, non-gamers, and they're quite incredible achievements.
I would say, so here's what I would say to this audience. What Patrick said is absolutely true. They're all incredible. Super Mario Odyssey and Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild are in my top two of the year. Mario edges
both
it out.
Both of them also Game of the Year finalists, by the way, as is Persona 5, which we mentioned as something you might not be interested in if you're not a core gamer. But
sure.
Zelda and Mario are both finalists for the Game Awards.
Yeah, they're up there. They should be. They'll win. I think the this is going to be a fight between two games on the Switch this year. I think this is where the fight will be. Not really a fight, but whatever. I will say this, though, for those listening to this show, the reason Odyssey just edges out Zelda for me this year, and just barely does, I think is because Zelda's got a difficulty level that is exacerbated by breakable weapons and a few other systems that I don't think are helping that game. I think that there's some things they could simplify in that game to make it a much more enjoyable experience. That being said, this is not much of a criticism, because the game's freaking amazing and redefines what we should expect from games like that. But all of that being said, I think that Mario is the most accessible, has the best kind of end game, is just an incredible achievement. So if you like feeling like you're 8 and living in a magical world again, Mario will fill your cup, man. It is amazing. Legend of Zelda is great, higher difficulty. And I'd say Mario Kart 8 is, despite the fact that it's basically a republish, is the best racing game of the year, in my opinion. I really like it. So, yeah, it's the Switch in general, man. Thing has just fed me what I want in 2017, for sure.
And the Mario Kart game is such a great party game or something to play with your kids. It's a really, really fun game. Mario Kart is always fun, and I think this one is one of the more successful ones in the series. And regarding Legend of Zelda, the feeling of adventure is unparalleled. The graphics are not great, but that doesn't really matter. You feel like you have a huge world to explore in a way that is more freeing than other open world games like Horizon Zero Dawn we mentioned earlier, because you don't have all of these icons and missions and collectibles and things like that that weigh it down, which are fun for that game. But Zelda is more, you know, the Breath of the Wild. You get into that game and you kind of have to inhale a little bit and then exhale and take it in. And,
yeah, it's a hell of a thing. Yeah. That game is, well, there's so much can be said for both of these games. It is a reminder that Nintendo continues to be a creative force to be reckoned with, and hardly anyone does what they're doing. It's just they set new standards, and then you expect the next 10 years to try to copy that, and then they come out and set a new standard. And I'm a big fanboy, but and I don't always agree with their decisions, especially on hardware and other weird stuff they've done over the years, but these two games are emblematic of what makes them great and why I never want Nintendo not to exist.
And I think I agree with you on Super Mario having the slight edge for me, because it's just something fun I want to get back to and get more moons all the time.
Yeah, more moons.
More moons. Yeah. And if you want to get a Switch or a PS4 or another platform you're not sure, well, you can go and listen back to the DTNS Labs games number one, which we did last month. And that's going to be it for this episode. I hope you got a good overview of what games are important this year. And I don't know what we'll do next time. Maybe a looking out to 2018, but maybe it will be a little bit early. We'll see. Either way, Scott, where can people go if they want more of Scott?
Well, if you're listening to this Labs episode, you'll soon hear a new Labs episode that I'll be putting together that deals with some more art tech. I've been focusing a lot on art technologies, digital tablets, that sort of stuff, how artists are working today versus how they maybe have done it in the past. And if you want to catch that, you can catch it right here where you get this. Outside of that, you can find me at Scott Johnson on Twitter, and all the shows I produce are at frogpants.com.
I'm Not Patrick on Twitter and on Facebook. You can find my shows at frenchspin.com, a general gaming show. If you enjoy gaming, you might enjoy that one. We talk about all sorts of games and gaming news. And the Phileas Club, which is a show where we talk about society, the world, issues with people from different countries, different cultures, and different backgrounds. We just did an episode about being a woman in our Western societies. We had four fantastic women on the show, and myself trying to be as silent as possible and let them speak. And I think you might enjoy that one too. So go check it out on frenchspin.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month. Bye.
Bye.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.